Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Porto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Porto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Porto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio on KVRF-FM in Palmer, Alaska. Tonight, we bring back the second part of our Joe Henderson interview. He is an Arctic explorer and author of Malamute Man. If you're interested in listening to part one, just make sure you check out our archives on mushingradio.com. Here we go. All right, we are back with Joe Henderson, the Malamute Man. His website is AlaskanArcticExpeditions.com. Make sure you check out his website. And if you get a chance, buy his book. It's there on his website as well as through Amazon and pretty active on Facebook as well. Joe, again, thanks for joining us here on the show. In the last show, we talked a lot about the logistics. We talked about your dogs, about the lead up to the expedition. My first question for you is tell us about that terrain up there on the Arctic coast. You know, a lot of people don't know what that's like, but you can go for miles and miles and never see anything except bumps in the terrain. You know, maybe a mountain here or there, but there are no trees. There is nothing that really stands out, is there?
No, there's nothing. It's funny when you sometimes there might be a rock, and you think it's maybe a cliff 10 miles away, and it happens to be a large boulder 10 feet away. Distance gets really, you can really get disillusioned on distances, especially on a foggy day. But we don't always travel on the coast, along the sea coast. Lately we've been traveling a lot of mountain travel, and the terrain there can be just as tough. The snow conditions there to start with is totally different from what you're seeing Fairbanks or even around Kofut area. The snow is very, very dry. It's considered a desert up there. And that's one of the trickiest things to deal with, because the sleds really have a lot of friction, the drier snow it is. And you can't tell how dry the snow it is unless you can. It makes a sound on your sled. And so, of course, the louder the sled is, the louder the grinding is, the drier snow is, which means you have to start really keeping an eye on those dogs. You know, they're pulling all their heart. I mean, they're pulling with everything they have. And where they gather their rest is going down hills. When the lines become a little bit slack, they get a few seconds rest here and there as the lines slacken. But when it's dry, the dogs are pulling just as hard down the hill as they are on flat ground or uphill. And so it's a really tricky thing, and you have to really keep a close eye on those dogs to make sure they don't overdo themselves. And we run into a lot of deep snow. I mean, that's one of the things that some valleys will be whipped clean of snow, just nothing but brown grass and patches of white snow here and there that's hard-packed and icy. The next valley can be snow up to your waist, soft, powdery, with hardly a bottom to it. You deal with everything. I mean, you have to deal with everything. Blizzards can come up at a moment's notice and pin you down. And those can be very dangerous if you get stuck. You know, if you're working hard and you don't get cover quick enough, the wind will go right through you and give you hypothermia. There's always a lot of steep mountain passes to climb. Those can be tricky because there's always crevasses on the other side, on the downhill side, on the lee wind side, and those you can't see. Sometimes it's pure white, like you said. There's no landscape breaking, nothing to break the whiteness, and you can crevasses are deep. They can be 10, 20 feet deep, maybe 300 or 400 yards long, 20 feet wide, and you can't see them until you're right up on them. Those are just some of the things you run into. Of course, you have the overflow that are always a problem, because in the mountains, the spring water is coming out of the pressure from the rocks and stuff is still warm. It's just a lot of things to deal with every day. It's quite a challenge every day. There's never a smooth day, really.
If I could go back to talking about the snow conditions itself, one of the new fangled pieces of equipment that a lot of racing guys are using this day are leggings for the dogs. Because of the deep snow, the crusty snow, they're getting a ailment called chicken foot or chicken leg, I guess they would call it, where the hair wears off of the dog's paws and of course makes it pretty much breaking snow through, you know, on bare skin. I know that your dogs are particularly bred for this, but how do you deal with problems such as that? Do you do something like we do in the sports with leggings, or how do you prepare your dogs for these different types of conditions?
As far as chicken legs, what you mentioned, I've never had that problem. None of the dogs have never had that problem, I mean. Maybe it's because they have such large feet and they bust a good amount of snow. I'm not sure, but we've never had that problem. It seems like they're so, they're perfectly built for that. I mean, they're originated, of course, on the North Slope, and they've been around for who knows how long, maybe thousands of years. We just don't know. But we don't have any problems. No, they don't wear booties, no leggings, no jackets. We don't use straw. They're just natural in that environment, and they actually thrive in it.
Let's talk a little bit more about the terrain and what you encounter out there. Did you see any wildlife out there, caribou, polar bear, anything of the like that, everybody thinks about that roam, the streets of Wasilla here in Alaska, and that's not so. It's a lot of that's up there where you're at.
Yeah, we see polar bears, of course, caribou, and we see seals on the ice. But polar bears, I don't mind. I mean, they usually run away, especially when they see such a large team. But then the grizzly bears are the ones that really come after us. If we see them in February, March, we know they're starving to death. They've been run out of their den for one reason or another, and they come at you, and they won't take any prisoners. I mean, they're coming after you to eat you or your dogs, and those are the most. That's the most dangerous thing are the grizzly bears. And we see a lot of wolves. Wolves will follow us, follow our trail. I've had them, come in before, and so they will try to attack too if they're starving. So there's a lot of other things like that you have to keep an eye on and keep make sure nothing happens like that. Besides the train itself, so it's a challenging trip, and you have to be careful. If you get hurt, well, that's your dogs are relying on you for their survival, and if you get hurt, more like you won't survive, and so your dogs won't either. So there's that aspect of it too.
What about people? Do you see any hunting parties out there or any sustenance hunters or anything like that? Obviously, these folks don't know you're coming. Do you ever run up on guys doing their own thing out there on the sea ice or on the tundra?
No, on a trip, I've never ran into anyone. I spent as long as 5 months traveling on the North Slope, and during that 5 month trip, I never saw a single person out there. Where I go is there's really, no interest for anyone else, to go there. I mean, there's the caribou are on the flats, so if anyone from the villages are going to hunt, they're going to be hunting on the flats by the coast. In the mountains or some of the remote places I go, it's too far for villagers to go. These areas are extremely hard to get to. Like I said, some areas take 3 seasons to figure out a route to get to it. So I never see anyone. No, I never have.
That's got to be amazing. I imagine everybody that's listening to this show is just thinking to themselves, wow, I deal with hundreds of people every day, whether I'm in the car or at work or, my neighbor across the street or whatever, and you can go 5 months without ever seeing another human being. That is truly amazing to me.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I've done it maybe 3 different times where I've gone 5 months or more. And one particular time, I had a puppy that left with me. Well, twice, actually, now I think about it. But a puppy went with me. She was born 10 days before I left. And so when we were done with the trip, she was 5 months old. And I remember the first time she saw another human being, she wheeled around and just took off running and disappeared behind the hills. She was terrified. It was really interesting. But, yeah, it's not seeing anyone for 5 months. It's for summer. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't make a difference. But
do you speak to your wife on satellite phone or anything during this time, or is there enough trust there where you pull off the truck, so to speak? You'll say, "Honey, I'll be back in 4 or 5 months," or what is the connection that you have out there, if any?
And nowadays we have the Iridium satellite phone, which is fantastic. I mean, it's especially with a baby. Yeah, I call in every night, so that's a real, real joy. You know, it's pretty darn nice.
Very cool. We're talking to Joe Henderson, the author of Malamute Man and an Arctic Expeditioner, explorer, it would be. My next question, then I'm going to turn it over to Michelle for a couple before we talk about your book and what's upcoming, is we had talked a little bit about in our first episode about a purpose. And I don't know if we got to that. Was there a purpose this year, or are you just out there exploring, or do you go out there and, I don't know, do research of some type, or what's going on out there for these expeditions? You just out there having the time of your life?
The mountains climbers, if you ask a mountain climber why they climb a mountain, well, they'll tell you because it's there. I basically feel the same way. I can, you know, I'm young. The Lord has blessed me with great health, and I'm still able to travel every day, days on end, and explore the Arctic. So basically, I do have a purpose. I always set myself goals, personal goals of going places and certain places in the Arctic. But basically, I feel, you know, the same connection as the mountain climbers who climb Everest or any other mountain because they can and because it's there.
My last question, Joe, is how in the world do you fund something like this? You know, you often hear about folks that do things like this, and first thing that comes to mind is the National Geographic Society or something like that. Is this all coming out of your own pocket? Do you have, I don't know, film crews or book deals or something like that that help fund you? Or how do you come up with the cash to do this year in and year out?
I come up with the cash from working 6 days a week, all summer long, at a construction company.
that fuels the habit, just like every one of us. We always work in the off season to feed up the freezers before next winter for all those dogs that we have in our yard. So very similar, I assume.
Yeah, and it's extremely expensive to do. I mean, it takes quite an effort, you know, to raise enough cash to do this every year. But I have great support from my wife and I have a lot of friends that help out, so I managed to pull it off every year.
Michelle, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Joe, I know in the early 1900s, the U.S. government was very interested in having explorers go up there and undertake the Arctic and you know, map it and figure out what's going on up there. Has anyone approached you for further exploration under that type of guise?
There was earlier on, the USGS were interested in the temperatures, temperature readings, and snow depth. But nowadays, with the new technology and satellites, and it's just not necessary. No one is interested in the real explorers anymore.
Well, I'm thinking that you, as a real explorer, can shed some light on the lower 48's take on the global warming issues. I mean, it sounds to me like we're in no threat at all where you go.
No. Last year was the coldest winter in recorded history. I had 65 below consistently for days and weeks on end. I had 99 below with wind chill. It was you know, something I've, you know, it was record breaking. So, and it's not the first time we've had extremely cold weather up there. It's hard to say.
If I could jump in here, I wanted to turn it over to Michelle, but a lot of folks don't have any idea what 99 degrees below zero is like. Can you describe that for us? How do you survive in something like that? You often hear the analogy where you can, you know, throw up a cup of coffee and it dissolves or freezes and crystallizes before your very eyes at about 40 below. But how is it there at 99 below? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, my wife asked me that. I could only think one word: invigorating. Actually, you know, I still traveled every day, even in the 99 below wind chill. You have to be really careful. And another thing that is really amazing to me, I'm not sure if it's well known, but over the past 20 years, I have really acclimated to this cold weather. I've only put on a pair of mitts one time last year. I wear just gloves, light jackets, and I haven't had frostbite on my face forever. So I have gotten acclimated to cold weather, and of course the dogs, they handle it like nothing. But the cold, you have to still be careful. If you feel yourself sweating, you know, from maybe hustling along a little bit too fast, snowshoeing, skiing. You better, you know, you have to be careful that when you start cooling off, it'll hit you like a ton of rocks. I mean, it hits you. And if you start shivering, you're in trouble. So you have to be very, very careful. And you have to keep, you know, you have to make sure all your toes and fingers are still feeling. You don't want any coldness whatsoever. It's just being very, very cautious, because if you freeze a foot, well, you know, the chances of getting out of there is slim, because you're going to get, you know, gangrene or something bad like that. So just have to be double careful.
Joe, one last question. What would you say to someone that was interested in coming up and doing an expedition with you that's not acclimated to that kind of weather?
Well, I would, you know, I mean, normally in April when folks come, it's very mild. Mid-March, it starts warming up. You still get some 40 below weather in mid-March, but most folks don't start coming up to join me until late March or sometime mid-March, but mostly in the milder times of the year. So, and it does, it takes them about 3 days to start getting acclimated, but nonetheless, they still have to be very careful. They have to change their diet, for one thing. There's no eating lean meat or lean food. I mean, you have to really increase your fat intake. And just don't worry about it, because that's where you get your warmth. And there's a few other.
Oh, go ahead, Joe. I'm sorry.
Oh, there's a few other things I'd caution. You know, they have to keep their feet warm. You know, never go out. No, never gear up with cold feet. Always make sure they're nice and hot and toasty before you put them in the mucklucks. I mean, there's a lot of things I kind of go over with them. But the main thing is the wind. The wind will really get people cold. And that's usually where, you know, if someone's getting cold, we just stop, set the tents up, and that's it for the day.
Are you using the latest and greatest gear, or do you go back and revert to some of the old timers with the skins and furs and that sort of thing? Are you fancy high tech, you know, Gore-Tex and down and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, the high tech you'd never be able to do this with high tech gear for this long a duration. You're looking at 2 or 3 months. All the high-tech gear, accumulates frost, which, you know, eventually you just wear an ice jacket. I resort to fur, and so I wear fur boots, fur parka, as much fur as possible. And then later on in the year, toward the spring, I'll start pulling out my down jackets and stuff like that.
So, Joe, we have about 12, 13 minutes left. When you were on our show last time, you had mentioned that you had just released your book, Malamute Man, and I want to talk about that. I'm sure that you're still promoting that pretty heavily. I know you do talk about it on Facebook quite a bit. And I also see on your website, AlaskanArcticExpeditions.com, you're trying to start up a new book. I assume it's called The Malamute Chronicles. Tell us about your writings. What are those all about? How do people buy it? Maybe a quick story or two from one of the books.
You can find it on Amazon, or a lot of the bookstores will have it, The Malamute Man. The new and those books are the first book is how I got started in the dogs and find my way to the Arctic and exploring, and a lot of dog stories. And my second book will be mainly dog stories, and I also want to incorporate some training in it. A lot of folks are interested in how to train for something like this. It's quite a bit of dog, training that goes into it. A lot of tricks to the trade that, are lost, of course. The old-timers probably used to train the same way as I do, but those guys are gone now. And so that's what the next book would be about, and hopefully I don't have time to do any writing in the summer because I work so many hours, but hopefully towards spring when I can have some time, I'll start penciling in some notes and start putting together another book.
Can you tell us about, I'm looking here at your website, AlaskanArcticExpeditions.com. Tell us about that black and tan dog that's in two pictures on the book here. I assume he or she is a leader, but looks a little bit different than your typical Malamute. What is his or her story?
Oh, the black guy, the small one, I assume.
In the middle of the
Bear.
Floor there, yeah.
Yeah, that's Bear. He's the old-style Alaskan Husky. That's what the Alaskan Huskies used to look like 25 years ago. Of course, they've changed quite a bit. But, I've kept that line in my, I keep that a separate line, just kind of old time's sake. But that's all part of my training. When I was a kid, I had a football coach that was just, he could take your weakness and turn it into a strength. And I've always remembered that and kept that as part of my training for dogs. And Bear had these short legs, stubby, and he just would not fit the team anywhere. So I put him in lead, and he took right to it. I worked with him, and he became one of the best leaders I've ever had in my life. He could navigate through a blizzard better than you could with a GPS. He was amazing.
And is he still a part of your team, or is he retired now, or what's his story?
Well, he went with me last year, and he's 11, I believe, 12.
Wow.
12, and he ran lead for a little while, but I mostly put him in swing position, and he helps teach my other leaders. But, you don't see very many lead dogs that can follow the wind direction in a blizzard like he can, or if he could see the snow drifts on the ground, which direction they were going, he could actually pick a course, a straight course, following a certain direction across the snow drifts. Just amazing leader.
Joe, do you ever have any questions or commentary from other mushers? And if so, what are the questions that they ask you in terms of education from that old school way compared to quote-unquote the new way of mushing, the way it happens today? Do you ever have any interesting questions from those folks?
Now that you bring that up, I really don't. Racing is so popular. I think I'm kind of a in the shadows of the mushing community, I think.
Well, just to tie it in with a lot of our fans, of course, our Iditarod fans, our guest last week was the 2013 Rookie of the Year. His name is Brent Sass. And he went off on a 3-4-5 week, I believe, expedition with a bunch of Norwegian travelers. So he does some of what you do in the spring, of course, after Iditarod and things. But he swears by this type of training, even for racing, is to getting out there and just doing these camping trips and these long hauls without any trail. And he's a different breed of musher than, you know, these guys that everybody knows their names about, at least down here in the southern part of Alaska from where you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I've seen him around. He goes up in the spring, I believe. But yeah, that's a great way to train dogs, I would imagine, for racing as well. Dogs learn how to navigate without a trail, which is great. It's great leader training, that's for sure.
So my last question, we have about 6 minutes to go, Joe. Again, Joe Henderson is our guest tonight. Malamute Man is his book. You can find it on his website, AlaskanArcticExpeditions.com, or on Amazon, and we'll place a link on Mushing Radio as well. Joe, what happens next year, 2013? What is the plan? Do you have a route that you're thinking about? Are you going to go someplace you've never been before? What's the plan for the next expedition?
Oh, yes. I'm definitely going someplace I've never been before. I'm kind of looking at the maps now, and there's some pretty challenging areas to go to, and I'm really looking forward to it, like wait for Christmas.
Michelle, do you have a follow-up question?
No, Joe, I can relate to how you feel about it being like Christmas. Robert's the same way. He's already watching the fireweed down here, lose its flowers, and keeps rubbing his hands together saying, "This, the snow's coming." So I do understand that Christmas feeling. I wish you a great season of exploring, and I hope that your little girl is ready to play that guitar for us next time we have you on.
All right. Thanks.
Well, we'll definitely have you back on. We'll just make this a yearly tradition. Every year that you come back from your expeditions, you're always welcome on this show because, again, your style is so much different than what people are used to, and that's the kind of guests I like to have on my show. It's not always about racing and, you know, getting from point A to point B as fast as you can, but enjoying the journey. I think that's a big part of mushing, and some of us miss out on that. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. It's like art, basically. It's not the art in itself, but it's the process of doing the art. And I look at dog mushing the same way.
Well, again, Joe, thank you very much. We'll definitely keep in touch, and I'll send over some links and things to you so you can post on your website. The first one will be this Wednesday, 7 p.m. That will be August 15th. And I believe the second part of this is not going to be until the first week of September. So we're going to have some lead up for part two. So I'm looking forward to having that on there. So we'll spread out your show a little bit and keep the interest alive, and that way we can get some comments and commentary back and forth, if that's okay with you.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. That was Joe Henderson. The Malamute Man is his book, and you can check him out on Facebook as well as his website, AlaskanArcticExpeditions.com. Make sure you check him out. He's one heck of a guy. This is a guy that you want to follow for sure. This is Robert Forto on behalf of my co-host and KVRF FM in Palmer. Talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.